welcome to Zero Hour. This is Tim Bowery. Today's show is an ongoing series that explores Richmond's thriving arts center and the people that make it happen. Every Friday at 12:30, we sit down at a Richmond cafe and have lunch with one of these artists. Conversation is live and spontaneous, so pull up a chair and meet some fascinating people. Today we are talking with Georgianne Stinnett, who is a photographer and a teacher here in Richmond. Her work has been widely shown across Virginia and published in numerous magazines and newspapers. And next month, she will be one of the recipients of the prestigious Teresa Pollock Award. Welcome, Georgianne, to Zero Hour, and thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you.
Before we get too far into, sort of earth-shaking, heavy-duty spiritual conversation about the ecstasies and the agonies of art, why don't you tell me a little bit about your background? So the folks listening know a little bit about you, because I have this horrible habit of just sort of launching into this thing, and people will call me up and say, so who was that you were talking to?
Well, I was born in Richmond, Virginia. Uh-huh. I've lived in Virginia all my life. Worked for a while in Northern Virginia as an environmental scientist.
Really?
And I didn't find that terribly rewarding. Uh-huh. It paid well, but it was not rewarding in other ways.
Yeah.
So I got together a portfolio and quit my job, and went to graduate school here at VCU.
Wow. How old were you when you did this?
It was in 1989.
Wow. So just the other day.
I wasn't even 30. Just the other day. Yeah.
Yeah. That's amazing, because a lot of people, I think one of the things that strikes me and probably a lot of other people is what, and you might not be able to answer this, but, you know, what gets someone to the point where they're willing to pull away from, you know, a secure job that pays well and not just say, well, I'll just do the job and I'll do the photography on the side, or, you know, whatever the compromises it is people make, and really say, I'm going to commit myself to this. What was that about?
I think there was such a contrast between the way I felt when I was working on my photography and making art and the way I felt when I was at work.
Yeah.
I mean, I knew that I wasn't satisfied at work, and I felt so alive and so like I was doing what I was supposed to be doing when I was working on my work. And on Sundays, when I would know that Monday next morning I was going to have to get up and go back and write some more environmental regulations for hazardous waste, to just it didn't thrill me.
Oh, so that kind of environmental stuff. Okay, so you weren't out saving poor whales or anything.
Well, indirectly.
Indirectly, right. Okay, all right. So was this something that you'd done, photography you'd done for years, or is it something you got into in your,
Well, I always liked art as a child, and I always felt right when I had a camera in my hand. Uh-huh. Like, sort of like I could hit what I was supposed to. Sort of like, I don't know why I felt that way, but it seemed correct. And when I was at UVA, I took a photography course, and really got excited about the possibilities of making images that way, serious images that way.
So you did your undergraduate work at UVA.
That's right, in environmental sciences.
Okay, all right. Well, as far as the progression of your work, I mean, when you started doing this seriously, I guess, in, 1989, I guess?
That's when I came to graduate school.
Came to graduate school.
And I actually took my first photo class probably in 83.
Talk about a little bit, if you can, about your work and how you approached your work back then, and then we can talk a little bit about how that maybe has evolved.
Okay. Back then it was really about looking and sort of a fascination with the visual world, the way I saw things.
Really?
Just really ordinary things. And my environmental science background sort of tied into that too, because I often had some living, it was a landscape or a picture of something that was alive or growing or that had died or somehow related to nature and human interaction with nature.
Right.
And so my first pictures were really about walking around looking at the sort of interface between what humans had done and the natural world.
Give me an example.
Well, the very first picture that I ever saw anyone that I made that someone became excited about was a picture of a dead bat on a construction site.
Really?
And I don't know that the bat was killed by a person, but the construction site was definitely an altered
environment
surface for me to find it. Oh, actually, it wasn't on a surface. It was on cement at Swannanoa. I forgot, in the Blue Ridge Mountains.
Right.
And it was this beautiful landscape, but it was this kind of tacky garden with all these artificial things in it where I found the dead bat. Really? I took a picture of that, and that I got a really strong response from that photograph from my teacher.
What was that about for you? I mean, the image it creates for me is that almost sort of that contrast. You know, you've got a well, obviously the image of a dead bat sort of speaks for itself. But, you know, did you say sort of like a tacky garden kind of? I mean, did it have globes in it and statues and all that stuff?
That wasn't obvious in the photograph. The obvious in the photograph, though, was that it was cement, and it was a hard surface that this mm-hmm. bat was on. It was a pretty close-up shot of it. But that sort of got me going and made me walk around looking for more things that I could move other people with and find exciting myself.
More things in reference to
the interaction between the tame and the wild, or the effects of human activity on wildlife.
Oh, okay. So there were still environmental.
Right.
Okay.
Indirectly. Right. I mean, I'm not going out making photographs to convince people that they should not use paper products anymore because look how the forest has been leveled.
Right.
I mean, there's a place for that sort of photography, but...
But that's not...
I'm not really interested so much in doing that.
Talk a little bit about the tame in the wild, if you can. What is that?
I think no matter how manicured or controlled something is that's alive, it still has a streak of wildness.
Yes.
And I find that really fascinating, that it can never really be knocked out of anything that's living.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's been something that's sort of run through a lot of different types of
photographs. Well, I mean, when you say that, I think about people. Mm-hmm. And I think about how we all struggle to, you know, act normal, I guess. do you know what I mean? And how what that act normal thing, how that concept changes over time. I mean, you know, acting normal, for instance, for a woman in the 50s is very different. Well, in some cases now, not all, but in some cases now is very different than it was, you know, just different now than it was then. So are you talking about all of the almost irrepressible human urges that culture, I don't want to get too abstract about this, but that culture somehow either does allow you to express or doesn't allow you to express, that kind of evolution?
Or just the needs that we have as biological creatures. Mm. I mean, we still have to be sheltered. We have to have food.
Right.
We have to exercise. We have these certain set of needs that are based on our aliveness
right.
that I think continue to motivate us no matter what our circumstances.
How do you represent that in your work?
Well, when I was working on the landscapes, I would often photograph gardens that had been meticulously or in some way obviously cared for.
Yeah.
But often there's something that is going awry. Yeah. That's just saying, no, I'm a daisy and I want to bloom right over here.
Right.
When you can look at it and tell that the gardener probably, if they were really, if they went out and did a quick little sprucing up of the garden, would probably snap that back. But I wouldn't find that worrisome because I think another daisy would just sprout right back where that was.
So it is almost a conflict between, I mean, it's almost a postmodern sort of concept that instead of having everything, you know, structured, controlled, organized, you know, that the world is a machine. If we can reduce it down to its simplest parts, then we can understand it as opposed to not really.
Right.
As controlled as you want to try and think you can get things, life really isn't that way at all.
Right. Yeah. I photographed topiary forms. Topiary gardening, the shapes that have been sculpted into shapes other than what the plant would take on naturally.
Okay. All right.
Like globes and triangles and cubes and animal forms.
Bunny rabbits.
Bunny rabbits.
Right.
And I think it's interesting that even these really, really controlled, say, boxwoods, even though it's been clipped and pruned, they're still an essential quality that isn't knocked out of it. It's still alive, even though it's been cut back to meet somebody else, to satisfy a human urge to decorate or control.
Right.
It's still this living thing that is its own thing, despite all of that.
Yeah. So that really talks more about our need to control. Well, yeah. I mean, basically what we were talking about, I guess, our need to control. Did we use the word chaos?
Chaos? We haven't said that word yet.
Yeah, but I mean, that sounds it's kind of like what
order
you're talking
over
about.
Chaos in a
yeah,
way.
Yeah, yeah.
But there's
when something sort of falls apart or maybe not chaos, but, you know, I mean, it's true. I mean, like anything, like a house, you own a house, and, you know, if you don't take care of it, pretty soon the gutters fall off,
right.
And then this falls off, and that falls off. And that's always, it's a constant going on constantly, a constant struggle, constant human struggle to keep from descending into decomposition.
Right.
Chaos. So really, so those are issues that you're really
interested
in responding
that. Yes.
to. That's amazing. That's really interesting. You also said, I see light as the signifier of soul and something else. What else do you see it as?
Soul or liveliness. Because you can take, say, a rock and look at it and it just looks like a rock.
Mm-hmm.
But if it's illuminated in a certain way,
mm-hmm.
all of a sudden it really can have quite a presence.
Right.
It makes it, even though it's technically an inanimate object,
mm-hmm.
it can seem like it's
right.
not so dead.
Yeah.
I mean, you still know it's an inanimate object, but it feels lively, or it has a sense of energy to it.
So, but when you said signifier of a soul, you're talking about, were you talking literally about, well, I'll give a really terrible example of this. The most beautiful woman I ever met in my life, absolutely, she was a New York model. I am not kidding you, 3 days later after knowing her, it was unnerving. I would sit across the table from her and I couldn't see her beauty anymore because her personality was so wretched. Her soul was so so dark and so disturbed. And I remember looking at her thinking, just 3 days ago, this was like the... Now it's like, I can't see it. Are you talking about that at all in terms of light as a signifier of soul and the way that it transforms things?
It's
the same way that, you know, someone, or the same way, you know, like, right. What's that television show, Ugly Betty or something?
Yeah.
You know, where you have this ugly person who has, you know, sort of radiates from the inside.
Right. And I guess it's light being energy suggests that radiance.
Mm-hmm.
And even though the light is describing the outside or the superficial qualities of a person, of like, mm-hmm. I'm looking at your face right now and I see the light on it, it suggests sort of the inner radiance.
Right.
Even though it's a representation. It's not literal. I mean, I don't see light as literally being, like, the light coming off of you is not your soul, but it suggests
your soul.
Yeah,
it is, actually. That's why you don't see the rainbows around me.
I see the unicorn over there.
Unicorn. Shh, don't tell them about my unicorn collection.
Okay.
Okay, we're going to take a short break here. This is Tim Bowring, and you're listening to WRIR 97.3 FM. Indie Radio. It's radio for the rest of us, and we're talking to Georgiana Stinnett, who is a photographer here in Richmond and will soon be receiving the Teresa Pollock Award for her work. This also comes from something you said, sort of the opposing pictorial qualities of darkness and light, separation and union, sharpness and blur, resonate with critical experience of being human. And it seems like as what we've talked about so far all seem to be talking about the human experience on some level, right? The human experience. Can you talk about that a little bit, about darkness and the light and the separation and union and the sharpness and the blur with the critical experience of being human? And keep in mind, we've only got about 15 minutes.
Well, I just...
Or you could just say no.
No, I'm not
going to talk about that.
Well, I guess... separation and union, when I see a body of an animal that's dead or go to a funeral home and see someone who's dead, it's just so startling to me how dead they are. I mean, it's that yeah. sounds really obvious and kind of dumb, but how there's something, it's they're
how,
not there.
How dead they are.
How
yeah,
dead
I
they
know.
Are. They're,
you know,
they're,
I mean, they look the same,
right?
But they're dead. You know, it's like, yeah.
And I guess it just calls attention to how... beautiful the vibrancy of life is.
Mm-hmm.
And by looking at something that's obviously not dead,
mm-hmm.
I mean, obviously dead, it sort of enables, this is really tough to, I'm not doing a good job of describing
this. Yeah,
it's
okay.
It's really, I think that's why I make pictures, because I can't think of any other way to say what I want to say.
Yeah. If you could say it,
that
you
works
write
as
it down.
Well. Right. If I could write, if I could just take a pencil and write on a piece of paper
right.
and communicate what I want to communicate, it would be so much easier than doing this. But it's so it's a way I say what I want to say.
So if you're talking about separation and union, right?
Right.
Talk about that a little bit.
Okay, separation and union. I guess the way I'm working now, I'm taking taxidermy armatures and illuminating them.
I'm sorry. What are you doing in your free time?
I take forms that a taxidermist would use to stuff an animal.
Right.
And I...
So they actually have these forms they use?
Right. You can order a form for an amazing array of creatures. It's kind of startling. There are companies out there that do nothing but sell this.
All right. So you have this form, and then the taxidermist sort of wraps the animal's skin around the form.
Right. If you shoot a fox and you want it in your den...
So it's not the fox's bones.
No, it's not the fox's bones. It's not the real fox. It's the styrofoam fox.
I always thought it was the real fox. I don't know why I thought that, but I thought, God, this must be really complicated to get all the stuff out of it that leave the bones. Okay, you're listening to Idiot Radio. Okay. All right, so you get these forms.
Right.
Right.
And there's pieces of styrofoam. Uh-huh. And sometimes I... paint them or put wax on them or put different things on them, but pretty much leave them in the shape that I find them.
Right.
And then light them in the studio to suggest that they are somehow, that they have the potential for a life in them.
Right.
Even though they're really inanimate objects.
Uh-huh.
And I try to show this to different degrees. Sometimes they're very brightly illuminated, almost like they're in a studio, like they're lit like a model would be lit for a photo shoot.
Right.
And sometimes they're fairly dark. And the forms themselves differ. Some of them are kind of luminescent because they're very light in tone. And others are, again, dark.
Right.
Yet they have this little spark of lightness to them. And I'm trying to suggest they're not dead. They're not dead. Seed for life. They are more than something that's actually alive.
So when you take a picture of a dead bat, you're talking about life. And when you take a picture of an inanimate object, you're
talking about life.
Well, you're talking about life. Getting back to... animal imagery in geometric form as totem or fetish. Mm-hmm. I don't even know. What does that mean?
I think we have certain animals embedded in our subconsciousness.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Like, if you see a bear, I think it conjures up certain things. I mean, it does for me.
Doesn't? Like, and what?
Certain, like, sort of scary, maybe protective.
Mm-hmm.
Strong, powerful.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, I made the first taxidermy picture because I saw these taxidermy armatures that a friend of mine had, and I took one into the studio and thought, I'm just going to slap this down and shoot it like it's a mugshot and see what happens.
Right. So you
and it was
lit it really bright and,
right, and you just put a very clinical
white,
lighting,
black background. Right. Okay.
And when I pulled that Polaroid, it was like, oh, that's it, because I had just had a dream where I thought there was this great big bear head in my room. It was like moving toward me, and that picture resonated with that dream. So I thought, I'm onto something here. This is the way I want to work.
So your work is a lot of the way you move is very sort of intuitive.
It is. It's extremely intuitive, and it can be inspired just by everyday activities. Like I'll have these sometimes when I'm not trying. When I'm doing something completely unrelated to technically making art,
right.
I'll see something that will unlock a problem that what I was having. Like sometimes I'll have these taxidermy forms, and I know it's an animal that I want to photograph or that I want to make an image of, but I don't know how to approach it.
Right.
And in doing something else with the form, showing it to somebody or just moving it out of the way because I'm moving books or something,
right.
I'll see it in a way that I had not looked at it in the studio. And then I'll go back after seeing it that way and go, oh, yeah, that was it.
Right.
And it'll work. Or I'll have a dream where something's happening and I can manipulate the taxidermy armature to echo that, and it all of a sudden works for me.
So for you, this is a... what makes this interesting is that it is difficult to talk about. And so for you, this experience of being an artist... as opposed to being, a technical writer, a scientist, which you and I could talk about probably fairly easily.
Right.
I mean, you know, tell me what you did. This, you know, we're struggling with because it is such a, I don't know, it's a very different way to live. It's a very intimate
it is.
Kind of way to live. And it really is a little bit outside the bounds of what people say, this is important. I don't mean to be dismissive at all, but if you walked up to someone and said, you know, I take pictures of taxidermy armatures, you know, pretty soon the guys in the white coats are showing up. But when you start talking about it and start talking about what that process means to you on an internal level and why that's interesting and challenging to you, I don't know, there's something sort of mystical and magical. It sort of sounds like you're talking about, like you're living sort of this almost, I mean, I know it's not easy, but like this almost sort of this fantasy existence.
I feel very privileged and lucky.
Do you? Yeah.
I do. I'm glad this is the way that I live, that mm-hmm. I didn't pursue investment banking or something where, you know, it would have been, well, some people who are good at that, more power to them.
Yeah, right, exactly.
I don't have a knack.
No, yeah, I'm not comparing that one is better right. than the other. Yeah, yeah.
But
just, did it feel like it took courage to do this, or did it feel like you just didn't have a choice?
It felt like I didn't have a choice, because when I look back, if I had been completely rational, I would have thought, no, that's nutty.
Yeah.
Why am I giving up the security and the comfort and the all the things that go along with a 9-to-5 job?
But didn't speak. But didn't speak to your soul.
No, I didn't.
And that's kind of what this show is about, because I'm assuming there are a lot of people out there who are living the other kind of life, you know. And one of the reasons they're doing that is because society says you should do that. And another reason is, they're not artists, so that's the kind of life they're going to live anyway. But I'm sort of hoping this will reach out to someone who's sitting somewhere writing technical information about environmental stuff, but goes home on the weekends and paints or sculpts or whatever, and all of a sudden hears this and says, maybe that's really my journey, you know? Maybe that's really the journey I should be taking, despite the fact that, well, what about the money? What about the teaching? I mean, how does that work for you?
Well, teaching, I just got a full-time job teaching at the Maggie Walker Governor's School.
Oh, great.
And I haven't had a full-time job since 1989.
Mm-hmm.
And
since 1989.
Since 1989.
Wow.
That's right. I'm really, really thrilled to have a full-time teaching job, because teaching is the one thing that mm-hmm. I feel like is complementary to my art making. I've had other jobs during this period that have threatened it or kind of encroached on it, whereas teaching, I think, complements it quite well, because I'm inspired by my students.
Yeah.
They're so excited. I've had the opportunity to travel with them.
Yes.
And I see them seeing things for the first time, and it's very exciting. It reminds me of that mm-hmm. Of that way of looking at things again, and it sort of refreshes the way I look at things watching them.
It's interesting. Joseph Campbell, who sort of interpreted Jung so that he could be comprehensible, he taught at Sarah Lawrence College for years, said that the totally cliched thing now, but so a young student came and said, what should I do? And he said, follow your heart.
Mm-hmm.
And it sounds like, you know, almost everyone I've talked to, including you, at some point made that decision.
Right.
To say, I'm going to follow my heart. And interestingly, the ones that I've talked to have been doing it long enough. Somehow it's worked. Somehow it's worked out. I just talked to somebody the other week, last week or whatever, who's also teaching, who loves it,
mm-hmm.
who says it complements my work. It's, you know,
right. mm-hmm.
you know, I was cooking in a restaurant or whatever they were doing, waiting tables or whatever. So it's amazing. Well, you're not going to believe this, but we are out of time.
Wow.
Yeah, it goes
fast.
By really fast. And I think we touched on some really interesting things, you know, how difficult it is to talk about that process that you do, because it is so personal. It is so intimate. It's, you know, you don't turn on the television and see people ads for, you know, hi, I'm an artist. And, you know, I mean, the language really in our culture isn't sort of there to contextualize it for people. So it seems like many of the people I talk to really are on a journey.
Mm-hmm.
They really are on a very special, private, wonderful journey, and I've had no one walk in here and say, man, I'm really sorry I decided to be an artist, you know. I think those people stop pretty early on. I mean, it is a choice, don't you think?
Oh, definitely.
Yeah. Yeah.
You have to stick with it.
Yeah.
I mean, there have been times when I thought, why am I doing this?
Mm-hmm.
Why don't I just go back and get an engineering degree or
right.
do something that would be much mm-hmm. more predictable?
Right.
But I never did. It's just yeah. they kept something would always happen that would enable me to keep going, and I would. And
yeah.
Hope yeah. I am able to continue.
Yeah, that's great. Good for you. Good for you. Well, it sounds like, you know, it's all a trade-off. You trade off some of the external stuff, but, you know, to feel happy and fulfilled on the inside, I think, is probably just a tad bit more important to most of us. Well, anyway, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Congratulations on the award again.
Thank you.
Thank you, folks, for listening. We hope to see you again for lunch on the radio next Friday. And once again, this is Tim Bell, Richmond's Media Radio for Westerners.